Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. In the investment world, few, if any, products have experienced as much growth as the exchange-traded fund. And within the ETF business, no firm is as large and as important as BlackRock. In this context, it was great to welcome Samara Cohen, Managing Director and Co-Head of EII Markets and Investments at BlackRock, to the Alpha Exchange. Through our discussion, we learn of Samara's start in the industry as employee 134 at BlackRock, before attending business school and then spending 16 years in fixed income at Goldman Sachs. Here she developed a keen understanding of bond market plumbing and the implications of post-GFC regulatory reforms for the design of future products. This focus on bond market structure strategy paved the way for her return to BlackRock in 2015. Samara shares with us some of the key milestones in the ETF business, including the electronification of bond market trading that came from the first fixed income ETF in 2002. Important as well for the ETF industry has been episodes of significant volatility during which investor demand for liquid and transparent macro assets surged. Our conversation next considers the business coordination required among Samara's team members to support the roughly 800 ETFs offered by BlackRock. Central to running a business at such scale has been substantial investment in technology and automation, and these proved especially critical during the market crisis of 2020. It was during this incredible surge in volatility, both in the stock and bond market, that investors utilized ETFs for price discovery and risk transfer in tremendous size. Lastly, we spend time on the people aspect of the business, a topic on which Samara is particularly passionate. She's proud that her team of investment managers within the engine is mostly women and plays an active role in the discussion among leadership around BlackRock's commitment to a broadening of the racial and ethnic makeup of the firm. In addition to being strongly motivated by efforts to increase inclusion, Samara looks forward and is genuinely excited about the prospect of bringing hundreds of millions more people into the markets and investing. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my discussion with Samara Cohen. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Samara Cohen. She is Managing Director and Co-Head of iShares Markets and Investments at BlackRock. Samara, thanks so much for being a guest today on the Alpha Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean.
Well, we'll have so much to talk about amidst these very uneven markets. I'd love to get a lot of your perspective just along the way in terms of a career that spanned many years in both fixed income and now at BlackRock across the product suite on the ETF side. But take us back to the beginning. Help us get acquainted with you in your early days in finance. How is it that you came upon a role in the investment industry?
So when I got to college, I really never needed to take another math class. So I was all excited to just be all in theater all the time. And I found that I really missed a quantitative curriculum. So I ended up doing a dual degree in financial engineering. I got a BS Econ in financial engineering and a BA in theater. But I spent all of my summers working for regional theater companies until my last summer, when I kind of had a realization that I wasn't sure I wanted to be in theater professionally. And I was looking around at some of what my finance peers were looking at, and they were all trying to get investment banking internships. And I didn't really know what that meant, but I thought it would be interesting to check out what I could do with the other major that I had. So I sent out a whole bunch of resumes. And to be honest, coming out of college, and I remind myself and other college students who I'm talking to about this, it's normal to not really understand a lot of what all these firms are and say they are. And the fact is, I sent my resume to BlackRock thinking that I was sending it to the Blackstone Group, because private equity was like really hot in the 90s. I mean, it's still pretty hot, but that's when I was applying out. And I sent my resume to investment banks. And the night before I got my BlackRock interview, I realized that what I thought was the Blackstone Group was actually Blackstone Financial Management. That's how BlackRock started. And BlackRock became BlackRock in 1993 when I started. But in 92, when I sent my resume, it was still in the same offices as the Blackstone Group and a kind of emerging asset management firm. And I went and I interviewed with BlackRock and with investment banks. And I really loved the story of this firm that was small at the time. I was employee number 134. There were 16 partners. Three of the partners were women, which again in 1993 was a pretty spectacular ratio. And the story was that they were looking to bring advanced fixed income portfolio analytics, which a lot of them had themselves developed on the sell side, directly to institutional investors and help them experience better outcomes in their own portfolio in that part of the market. And the story was really compelling for me, as were the people. So I went to BlackRock and I really enjoyed it. I decided after 4 years, I wanted to go back to school. And I went to business school and Goldman Sachs hired me out of business school. And I spent the next 16 years on the trading floor at Goldman Sachs. And I think that's where my theater major kind of kicked back in, like the trading floor and the engagement in macro markets very broadly. It felt a lot like putting on a big complicated show. So that's kind of where I realized I'm able to use both sides of my brain and I'm going to go forward with a career in finance. So kind of an unusual way to get started in the business, but that was mine.
Well, I just love this overlap between theater and financial engineering. I think when BlackRock was probably reviewing their incoming resumes, that was probably the only overlap between these two. And so interesting that you were starting out in theater and added this very different, but maybe complementary, as you say, more quantitative underpinning in financial engineering. I'd love to learn more. We'll, of course, spend the bulk of our time talking about your role at BlackRock and the product that BlackRock produces on such a global basis and in such scale. But before that, I would love to learn more about your lengthy time at Goldman Sachs and fixed income. What was, just in terms of the dates over which that period was?
So I was there when I graduated business school in 99. I did a summer associate position on the trading floor in 98. And then I was there from 99 to 2015. And actually, I realized, of course, I am now back at BlackRock. And I came back then in 2015. But I was gone for 18 years. So I'm a very long-dated repo, so to speak. But that's what we call the BlackRock boomerangs. But I was on the trading floor at Goldman most of my career in interest rate derivatives. And in really between, let's call it 2010 onward, I became much more focused for the business on market structure strategy, really as a result of the market reforms that were unfolding around the world as a result of the financial crisis and the OTC market reform that followed those experiences. And so I think in that period of time, first I read when Dodd-Frank was written, summer of 2010, I read Dodd-Frank. I read Title VII of Dodd-Frank, which is specifically reform of the derivatives market. And at that point in my career, I don't think I really understood the difference between a statute and regulation, but it was very clear that these principles would be massively impactful to the markets in which I had spent the bulk of my career. And for me, I thought they could be impactful in a pretty positive way. Now, there are lots of things that I might have written differently in Title VII of Dodd-Frank as an industry practitioner, but the principles of derivatives reform around reduced counterparty risk, increased transparency, more multilateral trading are sound market principles, and they really resonated with me. And so I really raised my hand to be a part of the business strategy and the development and delivery of how we would adapt our own business to these changes. And it actually kind of brought me full circle back to BlackRock. I started re-engaging with some of my former colleagues. And when I started talking to BlackRock again, this was 2014, I didn't really know what an ETF was, but I was decidedly a bond market person and an OTC derivatives market person. But the more I learned about ETFs, the more I realized they could actually be a really critical solution and part of the future of the bond market and of the derivatives market and of the futures markets, kind of the listed derivative markets. And at the same time, BlackRock, knowing the same, they had plenty of ETF and equity expertise, but they wanted somebody who knew bond markets and knew OTC markets and could potentially help position ETFs for broader participation in those markets. So that's how I ended up back at BlackRock and in my current seat.
Wonderful. And as we talk about your role at BlackRock and then really talk about this significant industry in exchange-traded products, I was hoping that you could, and I know this could be an hour plus type of conversation, so I'll ask you to see if you can keep it more 30,000 feet. But if you go back and you think about the creation of the exchange-traded product, can you give us some markers in terms of milestones, significant events in the industry, areas of growth in the industry that were quite important in terms of enabling future growth? It's obviously a product segment that's just experienced a significant increase in assets under management, of which BlackRock is a huge part of that. But as you think back just on the industry that is the exchange-traded funds industry, what are some of the really important milestones that you can share that just from your perspective have enabled this product to become so important?
Well, look, I actually think, Dean, in order to really appreciate the trajectory of growth in ETFs, you want to go back even further to the inception of the first index product, which was actually in 1971, which, and this is one of my favorite fun facts, was also the same year as the invention of the microchip. I think that both index investing and the microchip share the fact that they are really disruptive inventions in technology. We think of ETFs and index investing as market access technology, and have been embraced as such. The microchip really enabled more and more people to access personal computing services, and index investing enabled more and more people to access the markets. So that was 1971. The first ETF in the US was listed in 1993. And actually, if you go back into the history of ETFs and why wrapping an index mutual fund into a product that could trade on exchange like a stock had a lot of momentum behind it coming out of the crash of 1987. If you do a lot of the kind of forensics around what happened in 1987 in the markets and portfolio insurance, there was a view that there weren't enough instruments that enabled people to trade large portfolios of securities on both sides of the market. A lot of the SEC's own work around 1987 kind of suggested there would be utility to an instrument that traded on exchange and permitted that sort of portfolio access. And the first ETF, S&P 500 ETF, was launched in 1993. And it went on from there with investors being able to access index outcomes, but to do it in an exchange-traded wrapper with the second layer of liquidity permitted by on-exchange trading. I think other key milestones were really the first fixed income ETF, which came 10 years later. And for me, as a career bond market professional, that's a critical milestone because, as you know, there are, I don't know, roughly, let's call it 300,000 U.S. corporate credit securities compared to whatever it is, 4,000 or 5,000 listed equities. And post-crisis, 99, when I started working on the trading floor, was the dot-com era. And everybody said, well, this is it. The bond market is going to electronify. The bond market really didn't electronify because it's very hard to facilitate multilateral trading in a market as fragmented as the bond market. Treasuries electronified pretty quickly, particularly on-the-run treasuries, where there was clearly a standard benchmark instrument, the off-the-runs less so. But credit really didn't electronify during that era where everybody thought we would see a big uptake in electronic trading. What really began to electronify the bond market was the ETF, and specifically investor demand for ETF, which allowed you to get broad fixed income exposures via stock market pipes. And to satisfy that investor demand, banks and market makers really had to invest in their capabilities to trade large portfolios of securities. And that's what began the acceleration of electronification of the bond market. So that is a key milestone. And then importantly, periods of acute volatility, the financial crisis itself in 2008, and also the COVID period in 2020 are both very good examples. If you look at ETF trading over that fall of 2008, you see that at a time that the market was becoming deeply concerned about transparency and the publication of level three assets was moving bank stock prices, the transparency of ETFs and ETF holdings was extremely attractive to investors. And we saw big spikes in ETF trading and ETF utility over that fall. And fast forward to 2020 in the bond market specifically, there was acute pressure for a number of reasons, particularly in March of 2020. And fixed income investors, as well as liquidity providers, really turned to ETFs for price formation, for risk management, and we saw a tremendous uptake in institutional adoption of fixed income ETFs by traditional fixed income portfolio managers, really starting that spring and summer, continuing through to today. So the fixed income ETFs are about 1% of global fixed income assets. Equity ETFs are maybe 10% of global equity assets. I think the ETF felt like a much more native instrument to equity market participants. But fixed income ETFs have really become, particularly over the last 2 years, integrated in bond trading strategies. So I think that growth, we will look back at the COVID period as a real turning point for fixed income ETFs specifically.
You make some great points there. And I think just stepping back and one, acknowledging that I think the number is about, 75% of the assets in the ETF industry are equities, but a non-trivial 25 are non-equities, and that's commodities, alternatives, and as you say, a lot of bond exposure. And you use the word equity pipes. I think that's so key. It's just the ease of use for folks that might not have an access to an ISDA or have the ability to trade through the CFTC regime on futures contracts. That accessibility has been excellent. You make another great point all the way back to 2008, which I was thinking about. I just remember looking at the relative amount of volume in some of the macro products back then, whether it was SPY or XLF was a big product. Of course, it's bank exposure. That relative to equities really got high. So the macroness of that environment, so much of which was expressed through ETFs at that time, that critical time, really gave investors instantaneous price discovery and the ability to, I would say, defend their portfolios when they needed to at a time of great volatility.
That's exactly right. Importantly, I would say in the 6 years now that I've been back at BlackRock, some of the fastest growing adoption of ETFs is from active portfolio managers who use ETFs for a number of reasons, one of which can be hedging or pivoting exposures in high velocity markets, cash equitization, and increasingly as an element of the derivatives relative value toolkit, increasingly we see active managers evaluate an ETF versus a swap versus a future to see what the most efficient wrapper is for their exposure in a particular environment. The answer isn't always an ETF, but importantly, an ETF is deeply part of the conversation right now. So sometimes a swap may make sense, sometimes a future may make sense, but increasingly, ETFs are used fungibly with those other securities. So I think for me, it's pretty thrilling for me to be invited to speak on the Alpha Exchange when I am really the ambassador of beta in the index investing world. But I think one of the most important things for people to realize that they probably underappreciate is how active the decision often is to deploy a beta market access vehicle such as an ETF. And our fastest growing investors often are other asset managers who are producing alpha and increasingly incorporating ETFs into their strategies to do so.
Well, BlackRock's infrastructure on this product is just so enormous, it's almost difficult for me to even contemplate. So I would love to learn more about the team. I think you've called it the engine, which is probably a pretty apt statement just given the scale of the products that you play a role in overseeing. Maybe just start with if you were to describe the business, maybe starting with the assets under management and where they're positioned, you had mentioned bond ETFs and factor type ETFs. How would you characterize where the AUM is across the various suite of products at BlackRock?
Well, importantly, as you said, ETFs, they're not an asset class. They're a wrapper, and ETF assets in the industry and at BlackRock really cross the spectrum of asset classes, of countries, and of strategies. So at BlackRock, we have actually more than 800 ETFs, and they invest really in 60 to 70 different markets around the world. And AUM and flows is always a function of macro market and market environment, but really we are integrated at this point all over the markets. I think that to your point, the engine as our nickname, I love that. The full team, the portfolio management of our index and ETF portfolios, and everything we do specifically to ensure quality in the secondary markets for our ETFs, all of those different teams fall under this blanket of markets and investments at BlackRock. But somewhere we got the nickname the engine, and I think it's perfect. We increasingly actually call our index portfolio managers engineers because of the complexity of the work that they have to do, which is probably another point that people don't realize is at BlackRock, inside our four walls, we have really banished the word passive. We use the word index, but there is really nothing passive about managing an index or an ETF portfolio. It takes a huge amount of engineering, really, to construct portfolios. Increasingly, especially in fixed income markets or outside the equity markets, we will often have a situation where the index may have thousands and thousands of bonds. The portfolio manager will construct a portfolio that isn't a full replication of the index, and they have to decide what the right portfolio construction is to still deliver the index outcome without having to potentially own all of those thousands of bonds. And of course, we have to manage trading strategies around rebalance events, reconstitution events. So it's really a feat that we have a lot of incredibly talented people from whom I've learned a huge amount in my 6 years in the index side of the world. And also importantly, I'll add, most of our leadership team in markets and investments is women. So our index and ETF assets under management are over $5 trillion. It's about 2.8 in ETFs and the rest in index portfolios. And I think that is actually the largest women-run portfolio of any asset manager in the industry.
At $5+ trillion, I wouldn't bet against that. That's fantastic. And I want to circle back perhaps at the latter part of the call just on women in finance. It's a topic I'm interested in, and we certainly have seen some good growth in, but I'm sure there's plenty more to do. In terms of your team, you've got a number of different sub-teams reporting into you. And again, I come back to this idea of scale. And like any industry that experiences a lot of growth, maybe it's necessary for the growth. We've seen a lot of fee wars. It's incredible just how cheap these products are to the end user. And to be able to provide something like that at that price would seem to lean so much against coordination and technology and scale. I was hoping you could just expand on that, just as you've watched the business since your time returning to BlackRock. Even in those 7 years, there's been a tremendous, tremendous growth of the product and of BlackRock's business. What have you seen along the way that you can share with us in terms of being able to scale it up and take the price down in the process?
Well, look, I think the story of scale and access to markets isn't unique to the ETF. The cost to trade in the markets, and certainly, actually, importantly, we've seen this a lot over the last year to 2 years with the advent of commission-free trading for lots of reasons. Technology has continuously enabled us to provide more value and more market access, which ultimately to us, what we care about is reaching more people. So to your point, right now we think there's about 22 million people in the world that own an iShares ETF, and we'd like there to be way more than that. So just starting in principles, our goal is to make investing accessible to more and more people. And those are ETF holders specifically. There are many more people. We think about 100 million people who access our indexing capabilities through their retirement funds, for example. So I think indexation has provided the ability to reach markets at lower and lower price points. And I think it's been a big piece of what's in the investor toolkit. So I think scale, if I think about it from an emerging markets perspective, or even an international equity perspective, if I want to go ahead myself and invest in international equities, I have to set up multiple bank accounts and custodial accounts and figure out how to do the FX transactions. And as an individual investor, that adds up really quickly and becomes expensive. So when you effectively use a manager like BlackRock, who can put all of those things together in one security that you access through an ETF, it's a pretty compelling proposition.
So in the last couple of years, Samara, we've seen essentially what was a new all-time low in the VIX of about 9 in 2017, and then a new all-time high in the VIX of 83 in 2020. So these markets go through some very chaotic periods, and 2020 was just as disruptive as could be for our country and markets and for businesses. I would love for you to share with us the process that you and your team undertook as it became clear that this pandemic was going to be a very, very substantial thing, not just for markets, but the way in which we were able to do business. Can you share with us maybe some of the preparation and some of the work that you and team did in and around Jan and Feb of 2020 as it became obvious that this disruption was going to be significant?
I'll separate it into two categories. First of all, it's work we have been doing to automate and scale our platform that has been unfolding over the last 5 to 10 years, where to manage securities and portfolios at the scale we do, we've really moved to what we call exceptions-based management, which means we automate where we can and we have critical oversight at areas where there are exceptions and you need people to evaluate something that's happening given a market event or a pricing event or something in the portfolio. That whole body of work served us really well as we transitioned, and all of the work that we've done through lots of market volatility episodes to put in place what we call stressed market playbook. So all of that work is work that we have been doing in the entire time that I've been at BlackRock. I started at BlackRock in 2015. So the equity market sell off in August of 2015 was a really important moment in looking at U.S. equity market structures and the effectiveness of market-wide circuit breakers and how limit up, limit down was working. So first and foremost, just to put out there, I think the work that we had been doing and the industry at large had been doing over the 5 years pre-pandemic was really important investment that paid off for the markets in March in particular and over the course of the pandemic. The one thing we did specific to the pandemic that I think made all the difference in the world was we started moving people to at-home testing very early in February. And I'm not sure what it was like for you, but for us, it was still pretty shocking how quickly lockdowns happened in the second part of March. At the time, we started moving people in Team A, Team B to test from home. It really felt like such a remote possibility that we would ever be in this fully virtual environment. But we committed to it. We committed to the testing. And that was a huge, hugely important factor because when we did actually all have to go and work home, we had tested, everybody was set up. And so really it was probably the first week was the week of March 16th that everybody was fully at home in the United States and in Europe. In Hong Kong, obviously, people had been working from home. And so that was also important too, because we have a global business. We were able to take a lot of really important lessons learned from our colleagues in Hong Kong. And so that period of time, looking back on it, we adapted pretty well and pretty quickly in an incredibly high velocity market, and not just a high velocity market, but one in which ETF and index strategies were increasingly, like we saw, exponentially higher volumes in ETFs than you did in the rest of the market. And that's pretty typical. The correlation between ETF trading and the VIX is well established. And to your point, you said at the beginning of our conversation how volatility is up a little bit this week, and we're seeing it in the percentage of ETF trading as well. ETFs, when the VIX has been a little bit lower, has kind of averaged over the last couple of months at about 23-24% of our overall U.S. equity volumes. And now we're well over 30% or 30%. And in the height of the COVID volatility period, ETF trading was about 40% of all U.S. equity trading. You also see spikes in trading, by the way, of other beta type instruments. So it's not specific to ETFs. You'll see futures volumes go up more than single stock volumes. You'll see index options go up more than single stock volumes. So the use of beta vehicles in high velocity markets is one that we know about, but meant for us, we were managing the portfolios and also we were managing ETF market quality, which means working with liquidity providers and exchanges to ensure secondary market stability, creation redemption stability, as we transitioned to work from home. So it was incredibly scary, but really the portfolios functioned smoothly and ETF market quality was strong, and it became a great story for ETFs and for index portfolios and for us, for our business continuity planning and ability to move quickly to work from home. But gosh, it was an unforgettable and acute period of time. In some ways, though, I would say those weeks and months initially of the pandemic, we were operating on reserves of adrenaline and energy. And in some ways, as volatility came off and people just really started to miss their families and the company of others, it was easier to keep teams together. We're really proud of how the teams came together. And also importantly, I would say this too, for the whole ecosystem of trading partners, that it takes a trading ecosystem to make ETFs function well. So with respect to the U.S. exchanges, the electronic market makers, the bank liquidity providers, I think as an industry, I'm incredibly proud of the transition to work from home we were able to make and how we were all able to deliver for clients. I was just saying that as the months have gone on, I think in some ways it's been harder to keep teams together and feeling like they really are together. And especially with, we've had probably well over 1,000, if not more, people start at BlackRock post-pandemic who have never been into a BlackRock office. And so we are returning to office in a staged way between now and September with a little bit more flexibility than we had in the past. So I think there will be a new normal, but we're really excited to be getting back to working together. We're heading into the end of May here, and we have the MSCI rebalance next week, which is a big event for ETF and index portfolios, and it's going to be an important convening event. We will have a lot of our traders, actually a full trading team in both New York and in San Francisco and in London for the first time since the pandemic. So we are all really excited about next week.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't say enough about the people aspect of our business, both, of course, meeting directly with clients, but also that energy that comes from meeting with each other and the generation of ideas or things to experiment with that might occur just over a cup of coffee. It's very difficult to replicate over Zoom. What an event that last March was. And I think, Samara, you made some great points there on ETFs that I just wanted to push on a little bit with you, which is the fixed income side. We know the S&P moved just an incredible amount. And then you had this period where the things like the TLT, the 20 plus year treasury bond ETF, first rallied tremendously in a risk off and then sold off. I mean, it was a real whipsaw there. And then you also had the other bond ETFs like the HYG, incredibly volatile in a way that we hadn't seen since the financial crisis. But, and this is where I wanted you to weigh in with us here, open for business and a source of price discovery in a way that perhaps the underlying market, the actual high yield bond market, might not have been. How should we think about this ETF that's trading and instantaneously updating when the bonds themselves that the ETF represents may go through periods of extreme illiquidity? How should we think about that from an end user standpoint?
I think what you said is exactly right, Dean. The integration of equity infrastructure to the bond market through ETFs has been incredibly powerful because it allows for price formation in volatile markets. So to give you a very specific example, and I have literally dozens of such examples, but on March 12th, which was in New York City, probably the last or second to last day that many people had in the office, LQD, which is an investment grade ETF, traded over 90,000 times on exchange. If I look at the top five bonds in LQD's portfolio, they traded on average 35 times each. And there are bonds in LQD's portfolio that didn't trade at all that day. So because of the velocity of buyers and sellers meeting each other on exchange 90,000 times that day, there was a very clear picture of a price point for the investment grade index that then created a really positive feedback loop to managers of bond risk everywhere, market makers, bank dealers who started using ETFs to help manage risk in their own desk, which in turn helped them be better providers of liquidity to their clients, and of course, end investors. So I think that that is how the ETFs coexisting with bonds, the ability for investors to see investment grade pricing on exchange was a really important tool and a really important element of transparency over the COVID volatility period. Now, importantly, we see this sort of thing happen all the time with ETFs. It's not specific to the bond market, but the bond market example over COVID was a really powerful one. More recently, something that's top of mind for me that's simply equities. If you remember a couple of months ago in the third week in March, the equity market in Turkey had a prolonged shutdown where there was no trading of stocks at all. And there are country ETFs, Turkey country ETFs that continued to trade on U.S. exchanges and also on European exchanges that gave investors the ability to agree and to set a price for Turkish equities despite the closure of the underlying market. So I think this price discovery functionality of ETFs has been a really important one for global market resilience outside of the bond market as well.
There is just an extraordinary number of ETFs, I think approaching maybe 8,000. And then, of course, there's so many types as well. You just mentioned Turkey. I've traded the TUR once or twice, not often, but you can go around the world, you can go around asset classes and now style factors, and you've got the more actively managed ones. It's an amazing how much there is on offer. And I was hoping to just talk a little bit about the investor side and probably starting with the premise that more is better. In other words, giving investors more choice. But there are certain ETFs out there that have probably gotten a bad rap along the way. We had that big VIX blow up in early 2018. The XIV just went to zero in a day. Samara, what's the balance between innovation and democratization, giving people access, and then also just making sure that the wrong products don't wind up in people's hands that just might not understand them?
Dean, I think that is one of the most important questions facing the industry, facing investors, and facing policymakers today, frankly. It is a great thing for investors that ETFs have made markets more accessible, more transparent, and given them the ability to reach parts of the market and construct portfolios that were really expensive and unavailable to individual investors before. And as I said before, we'd like there to be hundreds of millions more investors in ETFs. So how do we do that in a way that ensures transparency and that investors really know what they're getting into? And to your point on the levered and inverse, in this case, inverse volatility ETFs, which we don't have any levered or inverse ETFs, but if you read the prospectuses, and I know you have, they were very clear on the risks in the fund. They had bolded, underlined disclosure saying the long-term expected value of this product is zero. And yet, as volatility went down over the couple of years into that spring of 2018, investors really bought those funds as though they were momentum funds because they were appreciating and performing like momentum stocks without realizing the potential price volatility. So how do we enable, encourage, support innovation without creating really what becomes a Tower of Babel so that it is impossible for investors to consume and really understand the risks? I think that the industry can do better than it has, and something we're big proponents of with a number of other asset managers. We have a coalition that has been pretty public over the last year in saying we'd like the industry to agree to some clearer labels for exchange-traded products. Just because something trades on an exchange does not mean that it is an index tracking fund. In fact, increasingly there are complex strategies that are intended to deliver nonlinear payouts relative to the underlying index, like the levered and inverse strategies. But even commodity ETFs can have very different risk profiles. And so the trick is coming up with a system that is meaningful, but not overly complicated. And we think the key categories that we'd like the industry to embrace are the classic ETF, the ETC, which is the exchange-traded commodity, the ETN, which is an exchange-traded note, which of course has counterparty or credit risk attached to it, and that last category, which is what the inverse volatility products would fall into, what we'd call an exchange-traded instrument. I think that would be a really helpful start, and what we've really asked all of the exchanges to do, because exchanges control listing standards, as you know, is we've asked them to make those labels a prerequisite of ETF listings, and if they do that, those labels will attach at the data feed level so that investors and importantly trading platforms that distribute ETFs can categorize them in a way that increasingly gives more clarity to investors. But that's our view and the view of this group of other asset managers and also brokerage platforms who we're working with to figure out how to address that problem. But I think it's a really important one for the industry to face.
I agree. The industry is pretty mature. It's certainly experienced a lot of growth. And in some ways, most of the products may have already been created, but there's certainly plenty of room still for innovation. And I would imagine that some of that innovation is coming from just your interaction with clients and what the demands are for BlackRock to help them solve problems on the portfolio side. If you were to try to categorize for us or characterize for us what that demand looks like from end users, the types of problems that they're uniquely asking you guys to help them solve, what does that look like at this point in time?
I think there are three broad categories. One we have talked about at length, and that is the increased penetration of the fixed income market by ETFs. ETFs are 1% of global bond markets, 10% of global equity markets. There is no question that there will be further growth, accelerated growth in fixed income ETFs, both in product adoption and indexation itself is in relatively early stages in the fixed income market. So I think that will continue to be a frontier of adoption and innovation. The second one, which we haven't talked about, but we know from what we hear from clients every day around the world, sustainability will be another theme and huge area of opportunity in making sustainable strategies accessible to investors through an ETF wrapper. And what ESG investing means to investors is it can be very different things. So there's lots of different types of products, and we think, we know from our clients that offering them choice, whether they want to screen, they want to avoid, they want to lean into an ESG theme, they want to actually identify leaders, the highest ESG scoring companies. That is a whole dimension of innovation that we are seeing a lot of growth in and demand for, and I know will drive a lot of our efforts over the next decade. And the last category is really what don't we know yet where the ETF wrapper can add value. And I listened to your, I think it was your last episode on structured notes and option strategies and how in low rate environments they can be increasingly attractive as bond substitutes. And we know we're seeing that in structured notes right now around the industry, which of course has nothing to do with ETFs. But a growing part of the ETF market is what's called defined outcome or buffered ETFs, which look a little bit similar to structured notes. And the SEC made some important changes to ETF regulation a couple of years ago that helps with the use of options. So I think that's a frontier where we don't have products, but I think we are watching it and others are as well. So that category of where we may be able to add something of incremental value with the ETF wrapper where it doesn't exist today. That's door number three.
Let's finish our conversation and talk about the people side of the business. BlackRock's a very large institution and you oversee a very large group as well with plenty of colleagues and business partners. We had touched on it a little bit earlier, but just the broad progress in terms of women pursuing and having their careers advance within our industry, both on the buy side and sell side. I'd love for you to just provide some perspective on that in terms of what you've seen, what you're excited about, what the hurdles are that remain in motivating those careers and helping them advance. How do you see that, the broad topic of women's careers in finance?
Well, thanks for asking me that. And also, Dean, I want to say thanks for the work that you do, because I know you interview women investors. And I think giving a voice and a platform to the increasing number of really impactful women in our industry who become role models for both men and women, it's really important. And so it's great that you do that. And thanks for having me on. As I mentioned earlier, our team of investment managers in the engine is actually mostly women. And the investment team overall is 50-50 from a gender diversity standpoint. I think you asked about our experience over the pandemic. One positive thing about the pandemic is that the interaction we had with each other in a distributed work from home environment was very democratizing. And in a lot of ways, we saw participation in meetings from people who had a harder time getting into the conversation in a crowded room or in two rooms connected by video conference. So the back to work period and the pandemic period have given us a lot to think about around inclusivity at work. How do we ensure people have voices? How do we bring the same intention to our own teams and our own talent strategy that we do to our work in the markets? And from a gender diversity standpoint, I'm really proud of what we've done. I'm worried the numbers are a bit scary. If you look at what's happened over the pandemic, the number of women who are saying they now want to take some time to kind of downshift in their careers or leave their jobs, I think it's been hard parenting in the pandemic. And for me, wondering whether I was at home enough before, now that I've been home and seen that there are places that I could help my kids and be helpful to my kids, or maybe I wasn't around enough. I think it's going to be an important period of time adjusting to the new normal and supporting parents and women in particular in that. And for us, we're also giving a lot of thought to how we can improve our racial and ethnic diversity, where we have more work to do. And I think we've learned a lot, and importantly at BlackRock have really leaned into having conversations around diversity in all dimensions and how we can improve it. And I think that's going to be an area where if we get it right, we will really differentiate ourselves and do a better job for our clients. So it's something that for me personally coming out of this year is as big a focus as ETFs in the markets.
I think for obviously everyone, this pandemic has just been incredibly challenging in so many ways. In terms of the work part of it, depending on where you were in your career, it could have been not as bad. For folks that were established and senior and might have pretty deep client relationships, being able to continue to tap into those from a work from home environment was possible. And you even freed up some of your time commuting perhaps. And so some people will say, again, just in isolation, the work part of it has been almost a net positive for them. But that's certainly different for young people in the industry. As you know, having grown up on a trading floor, that sort of osmosis, learning just in being around the floor and hearing the chatter and seeing client conversations, that's invaluable and so difficult to access in any way from a work from home environment. So I'm curious if you could talk to us a little bit about that in an environment where even if people go back to work, it may not be 5 days a week. How should we think about the younger folks that are coming up into the industry and the opportunities for them? Is there a different tack that we're supposed to contemplate from a mentoring perspective? What are your views on that?
It's a good question about mentoring. I think that mentorship is something that we can maybe do a better job of with the technology connectivity that we have. I can have somebody in London mentor somebody who's in New York, and for a lot of reasons running a global trading business, there can be a lot of positive outcomes to that. Look, I did grow up on a trading floor. I am the first person to say, I think you learn so much by osmosis. You build relationships, you build trust, but things are different today. And I think balancing what I think is important with what our incoming developing talent wants is going to be just an ongoing question. And I ask the question every single time I talk to new analysts and associates, particularly as we seek to bring in a much more diverse population of hires. We'll see lots of different models. And for us, hopefully, we will try different ones and come up with the ones that gives us access to the broadest, most diverse talent we can get, and also keeps them engaged and wanting to grow their career. I do think that having been through two maternity leaves myself, there's a lot that we've learned in the remote environment that maybe can be applied to parents who are struggling with making the transition of coming back to work with small kids. So I'm not sure the answer is exactly what it looked like when I was growing up on a trading floor. I'm also pretty sure the answer is not fully remote, but I think there will be a lot of models in between that, if we get it right, will allow us to have a broader, happier, and more productive workforce. That's my hope.
That's great feedback. And as we're a year past the worst part of the pandemic and the vaccine's been rolled out, let's hope the take-up doesn't stall out, but certainly we've made a lot of progress on getting shots in people's arms, and there's this promise of more fully engaged economy and more fully engaged society. At BlackRock, in terms of your day-to-day and what your team is working on, what are some of the things that, as you look forward the next year, the year after that, product development, things you're hoping to achieve, what, Samara, gets you most excited?
What gets me most excited is hoping to bring hundreds of millions of more people into the markets and into investing. I think we've all watched with fascination and maybe with mixed feelings sometimes at the real acceleration of retail engagement in the markets. And there is something I think that's really positive and really important about individuals engaging more in the markets and in investing. And hopefully we can lean into that and ensure that we develop market structure over the next decade plus that is supportive and positive for retail engagement. And if we do that, we will create more investors and more people all over the world who have better and more secure financial futures. And as such, they can do whatever it is they want to do most every day in their work and in their lives, because they don't have to worry as much about the things that they want for their kids, for their retirement. And so that is what makes me come into work every day, is making sure the markets are set up for that sort of growth and that sort of participation, and that we have products that can deliver into it.
Yeah, I think you want the products to work. You want them to be transparent. I also would just say that finance education for folks, we're in the industry, so we almost take it for granted, but there's so many people intimidated by the products and don't have access to the products. And so I think it's an important goal and an important outcome to get more people access to the right kinds of products. So excellent. Well, Samara, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on the Alpha Exchange. It's been awesome to learn not just more about your time at BlackRock, but your career in general, the arc of your career and how you've landed in this significant role in providing products to not just the biggest investors in the world, but also individual investors, or big clients of yours as well. So thanks, Samara, for spending the time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.